Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 7th day of December, 2019. There's plenty of infamy still going around. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and let's start off with a bit of that and get the impeachment farce out of the way right up front. Because there really is important news to talk about. Sometimes you have to blow that smoke out of the way first so you can really see it. The sorry socialist heading up the House Judiciary sick committee, Jerry Nadler, called in four of the sorriest excuses for so-called constitutional lawyers you'll ever see. Well, come to think of it, though, I'm surprised he didn't include Barry Sotero on the list. And besides being far-left nutcases, the only other thing they really seemed to have in common was a complete disdain for the text as written and for the history of these United States to boot. And I guess we shouldn't forget Trump derangement syndrome as well. One of the worst of the bunch, Pam Carlin, not only seems to hate the president specifically, perhaps because when he deep-sixed Hitler, he deep-sixed her chances of wearing a black robe and sitting on the Supreme Court too, but she seems to hate all white men in general. After the Bolshevik parade was over, Tucker Carlson aired a video of the Stanford professor from 2006 berating all white men in a racist, sexist rant. But remember, she's far left, so it's okay. Truthfully, though, the only thing that she said that was actually noteworthy was her below-the-belt attack on the president's 13-year-old son, Barron. Ultimately, what she demonstrated is that she's kind of like Kathy Griffin, only not as funny and certainly not as constitutionally literate. The real trouble is, even she looked good, though, compared to the first so-called constitutional scholar rolled out by Team Bolshevik. Noah Feldman not only called for Trump's impeachment almost immediately after he was sworn in, he actually argued in a New York Times op-ed back in 2008, entitled Why Sharia, that Islamic Sharia law was superior to the Constitution anyway. More humane, even. Well, that is, if you swing far enough to the left. No, I'm not going to quote it, and as Christina Layla pointed out for the Gateway Pundit, this tells you pretty much all you need to know about what the Democrats are trying to pull. Oh, and it goes a long way, too, to pointing out just why it is that American so-called jurisprudence is in such a sorry state. So perhaps the best way to summarize the test-lying part of the circus was Representative Matt Gaetz summarily silencing all three of the panelists when it came to anything they actually knew about anything actually related to the impeachment. But he kicked it off by pointing out graphically the hubris of Pamela Carlin and her hatred for anything that not only smacks of original intent in the Constitution, but conservatives who might read it, too. And he did so by reading a quote of hers, where she said that while liberals really like each other and get along so they want to be close, conservatives clearly can't stand one another, which is why they have to spread out, like in rural areas.
Especially very conservative people tend to spread out more, perhaps because they don't even want to be around themselves. Did you say that?
Yes, I did.
Do you understand how that reflects contempt on people who are conservative?
No, what I was talking about there was the natural tendency, if you put the quote in context, the natural tendency of a compactness requirement.
Which you probably wouldn't even be able to understand anyway, so I'm going to try to see if I can't baffle you with BS here.
To favor a party whose voters are more spread out.
Well,
and I do not have contempt
hold on.
I'm very limited on time, Professor.
And so I just have to say, when you talk about how liberals want to be around each other and cluster, and conservatives don't want to be around each other, and so they have to spread out, it makes people, you may not see this from, you know, like the ivory towers of your law school, but it makes actual people in this country feel like, excuse me, you don't get to interrupt me on this time. Now, let me also suggest that when you invoke the president's son's name here, when you try to make a little joke out of referencing Barron Trump, that does not lend credibility to your argument. It makes you look mean. It makes you look like you're attacking someone's family, the minor child of the president of the United States. So let's see if we can get into the facts.
All right, and here he shifts gear, and he's now going to pose this question, as he puts it, to all of the witnesses. And this is really precious.
to all of the witnesses, if you have personal knowledge of a single material fact in the Schiff report, please raise your hand. And let the record reflect, no personal knowledge of a single fact. And you know what? That continues on the tradition that we saw from Adam Schiff, where Ambassador Taylor could not identify an impeachable offense. Mr. Kent never met with the president. Fiona Hill never heard the president reference anything regarding military aid. Mr. Hale was unaware of any nefarious activity with aid. Colonel Vindman even rejected the new Democrat talking point that bribery was invoked here. Ambassador Volker denied that there was a quid pro quo, and Mr. Morrison said there was nothing wrong on the call. The only direct evidence came from Gordon Sondland, who spoke to the President of the United States, and the President said, I want nothing. No quid pro quo.
All right. Well, that pretty well summarizes it. But in fairness, there was at least one witness, and he actually swung from the left side too, but was called as a witness by the minority, who did, in fact, know what he was talking about. And that's the George Washington University professor, Jonathan Turley. And as Jim Hoft at TGP summarizes it, the man absolutely destroyed the coup-plotting Democrats in his opening statement, making a number of, you might call them, valid constitutional points, like the idea that impeachment was supposed to be based on proofs, not presumptions, and that what we're seeing here was the, quote, narrowest impeachment in history, to the point where the words high crimes and misdemeanors ought to be applied to them, along with the term abuse of power for what they're trying to get away with. Here's how he put it.
If you impeach a president, if you make a high crime and misdemeanor out of going to the courts, it is an abuse of power. It's your abuse of power. You're doing precisely what you're criticizing the president for doing. We have a third branch that deals with conflicts of the other two branches. And what comes out of there and what you do with it is the very definition of legitimacy.
And obviously, what we saw in the circus yesterday is the opposite. As it turned out, though, Professor Turley still wasn't quite done, and he added this admonition to his comrades, even further left than he, there on the committee. And it sounded to me like he was challenging them to see whether they really had any integrity at all. Said the honest, old-fashioned liberal, "My personal views of President Trump are as irrelevant to my impeachment testimony as they should be to your impeachment vote. I'm concerned about lowering impeachment standards to fit a paucity of evidence and an abundance of anger." Unquote. In a related story, at least in a totalitarian sort of a way, nutcase professors don't seem to be limited to the United States, nor to their totalitarian impulses. This comes from Thomas Lifson at The American Thinker, who asks, what's the carbon footprint of a military invasion? And where's the army that the United Nations would use to invade a country that emits the CO2 that actually makes the world greener and greener? Lifson says, this guy makes me even happier that I ditched academia after getting my PhD and teaching at Harvard. Simon Kent, reporting for Breitbart, said the following, "The United Nations may resort to military action against states that defy its mandates on global climate action, according to Ole Waver, a prominent international relations professor at the University of Copenhagen. In an interview with ABC News Australia, the professor cautioned about what he sees as climate inaction and how it might draw the United Nations into considering other means to ensure that its bogus goals are met, even if that leads to armed global conflict. And, says Lifson, the totalitarian impulse behind the warmest agenda is clearly visible. Here's the quote. If there was something that was decided internationally by some more centralized procedure, and every country was told, this is your emissions target, it's not negotiable, we can actually take military measures if you don't fulfill it, then you would basically have to get that down the throat of your population. Achtung, said the professor, whether they like it or not, unquote. And as Lifson puts it, there you have it. Global dictatorship justified by an international climate hoax. Does it get any more sinister? And sadly, folks, the answer is, yeah, it really does. There is, after all, 5G that's also going to be rammed down your throats and into your brain, whether you like it or not. There is some good news on that front, though. The Activist Post reports that the second largest insurance firm in Switzerland, Swiss Re, classifies 5G as a high-impact liability risk when it comes to their latest annual risk report. And the background says this. In February, telecom execs gave congressional testimony admitting they had no scientific evidence whatsoever that 5G is safe. And of course, as you're probably aware, many doctors and honest scientists say it absolutely isn't. People and pets have already become sick where it's been installed. B.N. Frank, the author here, cites a number of cases to make that point. Despite increasing worldwide opposition too, along with warnings and lawsuits, he gives some more links for that point, companies are still installing it anyway. And many would consider that to be very risky, especially considering that, number one, insurance companies do not tend to do business with telecom companies anymore. He cites some references. And number two, telecom companies have been warning investors for years that eventually, if people ever wake up, they may be held liable for the incredible amount of harm being caused even by their existing devices and transmitters. And in fact, there's currently a smartphone class action lawsuit due to phones exceeding federal RF safety levels that probably are way too low anyway. So he says it's not really surprising that Swiss Re has classified 5G as what they call a high impact risk. And it's one of the top five emerging risks, as a matter of fact, in their 2019 Sonar report. Having to do with things like digital technologies clash with legacy hardware, potential threats from the spread of 5G mobile networks, increasingly limited fiscal and monetary flexibility by those central banksters, genetic testing implications for life insurers, and the impact of so-called climate change. And I think by that they mean both the real and imagined kinds on the life and health sector. From there we go to the continuing invasion of the United States and the evil that it's being used to justify. As it continues apace. First, under pressure, says a headline from Breitbart, the Mexican governor of the state just adjoining the border that was the scene of that most recent massive gunfight has backtracked after officially declaring, at least for a while, that those 150 Los Zetas gunmen entered Texas on their way to the attack. You heard that right. Just hours after saying that a group of about 150 cartel gunmen, I guess we have to say fast and furiously and illegally, snuck into Texas through a series of dirt roads and over the border river before they crossed back into Mexico to attack a rural community in that shootout that killed at least 23 people. Yeah, call it yet another gun-free killing zone that turned out not to be. The governor of Coahuila is now walking back his statement, claiming, ah, so sorry, I don't think the gunmen actually crossed the international boundary after all.
That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Or on second thought, maybe not. On Tuesday afternoon, the governor Miguel Angel Riquelme reversed his verbal statements issued just hours before, where he said that gunmen from the Cartel del Noreste, CDN faction of Los Zetas, actually did enter Texas as they made their way from Nuevo Laredo to Coahuila. And then somebody seems to have gotten to him.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Because this is what he said not too much later. What I said was that our territory is vast in our borders with Texas, Tamaulipas and Nuevo León, a part where there's nothing but desert, where it's unknown whose limits they are. That is where they tried to go around to enter the ranches and enter directly to Villa Union, he was quoted by El Norte. It doesn't mean that they crossed the river or that they actually entered the U.S. And, of course, the reversal, they note, comes after his statements caused an uproar about cartel gunmen temporarily, at least, yeah, when it suits them, crossing into Texas. By the way, there's more follow-up on that story, and it's especially important to ponder if the coup planners get their way. The official revelation, says the Breitbart story, is the first of its kind where cartel gunmen admittedly crossed into Texas before carrying out a series of attacks. Certain portions of the Rio Grande River, they note, are shallow enough to allow a four-wheel drive vehicle to cross even without having to deploy a makeshift bridge. But officials didn't specify the means of crossing in this case. As Breitbart, Texas has previously reported, four police officers and 7 to 10 gunmen died in the initial shootout, with at least 7 more dying in the hours following the incident. And information released since then revealed that the gunmen managed to kidnap a number of locals as they fled Villa Union, including 2 firefighters whose dead bodies were later recovered. One measure that obviously won't make any difference on that score, but certainly will advance the interests of the almighty police state, is this one. And I like Daisy Luther from the Organic Preppers take on exactly where it's headed. Her headline says, DHS wants mandatory Aktung photographs of American citizens. Because, yes, the Department of Aktung, Homeland Security, is hard at work thinking of ways to make travel even more miserable and invasive than it already is for the rest of us peons. And the chances are good they're not planning to stop just with travelers. The latest, though, they want to take photographs of every person leaving and entering the U.S. and store all of this biometric information in their databases. So whether you're an American citizen or not, they'd like to invade your privacy for no other reason than that you're traveling outside the country. The claim is it's about enforcing visa deadlines for foreign travelers who overstay, which is another perfectly good reason for making sure you come across the border illegally from the south if you're really ISIS or a Los Zetas terrorist, and find your way into California sanctuary cities, or some of the others proliferating around the formerly free United States. Well, don't worry, she says. The transportation sexual abusers just want to enhance, quote, aviation security and the passenger experience. Yeah, their experience of your privates. But, hey, wait a minute. Did you know this? Biometric scanning is already being used for foreign travelers. So what's the point, right? The thing is, foreign travelers entering the U.S. must already submit to being photographed, fingerprinted, and scanned. So here's the new hitch. Government officials have made no secret of their desire to expand their use of biometrics, which they claim could identify potential terrorists, unless, of course, they get to a sanctuary city and manage to do what they've been doing for so long anyway. Or, as we've seen lately, end up in Congress. Which brings Daisy Luther to the $64 billion question. Why on earth do Americans also need to be scanned? And what's the excuse? And while previous regimes have certainly pretty well worn this path, the Trump administration isn't trying to reverse anything here for sure. The DHS says the new Trump administration plan would be part of a broader system to track travelers as they enter and exit the United States, and that includes formerly free Americans. Because obviously, when we lower the final boom and put the mark of the beast in place, we need all of this data already. Daisy points out that biometric systems are already being rolled out, of course. They reported months ago about Atlanta, which had set up scanning devices. Although, at least for now, travelers still think they can opt out. She says, when I flew into the U.S. last spring after taking a course in Bosnia, they had biometric scanning at the Dulles International Airport in Swamp Central. The agent said to me, put your face right here and don't blink, as she pointed to a contraption that looked like something you'd see in an optometrist's office. What's this? I asked, holding up the line. Just an iris scan, ma'am. Put your face up to the device, she answered with a barely concealed eye roll. Well, I replied, I don't consent to sharing my biometric data. And while I expected to be escorted away and cavity searched, she instead sighed deeply, scanned my passport, and said, say it with me, folks, move along, move along. However, once they get what they've planned on in place, there won't be an option anymore to opt out. Oh, and there's this, too. Not to worry, because DHS promises, just like they did with your naked body scans, unless they show up on the web, they claim they'll be deleted within, half a day or so. Trust us, have we ever lied to you before? And finally, she notes, hey, does anybody remember just how many breaches we've seen of sensitive government information over the last, just couple of years? There was the data breach that exposed the personal information of some 21.5 million federal employees, the Obamacare data breach that compromised the medical privacy of 75,000 people, in fact, tons and tons more, up to and including OPM, the VA, and a database of almost 200 million registered U.S. voters. So, yeah, they will treat your biometric security and naked body information just as carefully as they have, for so long now. We do need a bit of good news today, even though the source is admittedly suspect, because it comes from a group of lawbreakers who put their hand on the Bible and then proceed to draw a paycheck violating the Second Amendment. I'm talking, of course, about the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and whatever else they decide to add to the list of soon-to-be verboten things. But they at least issued a new study recently showing 423 million guns that they've basically registered or know about in the hands of formerly free Americans. Note Steve Watson in InfoWars. Isn't it amazing that that corresponds to a violent crime rate decrease of over 48% in tandem with that dramatic rise in gun ownership? This number, by the way, amounts to about 1.2 known guns for every person in the country. Over 8 billion rounds of ammunition were produced as well during the same time frame. And the figures, they say, reveal that the most popular firearm in the country is the much maligned sporting rifle, a.k.a. the misnamed assault rifle. And the AR-15, of course, is one of the most popular models we're talking about here. The findings highlight that there are now 17.7 million of those in private hands. That's a record high. And they amount to more than half, or 54%, of all rifles produced in 2017. Said the National Shooting Sports Foundation, referring to the ATF figures, firearms and ammunition manufacturing accounted for 12,000 jobs or so in the United States and created over $4.1 billion of goods shipped during the year 2017, said Joe Bartosi, the president of the organization. These figures show the industry that America has a strong desire to continue to purchase firearms for lawful purposes. And the modern sporting rifle continues to be the most popular centerfire rifle sold in America today. It's clearly a commonly owned firearm, with more than 17 million in legal private hands. And yeah, he observed, as lawful firearms ownership in America continues to grow, criminal and intentional misuse of firearms is falling. Because, quote, during the 25-year period covered in this report, i.e. 1993 through 2017, the violent crime rate has decreased by almost 50%, while unintentional firearms-related fatalities have declined by 68%. And at least a few people are openly thanking the Bolshevik gun banners for spurring the desire of honest Americans to buy those liberty teeth while they still can. Let's start now to wrap up this first segment today with some, well, let's call it good news and bad news from what's arguably the world's most truly evil company. And they don't even try to hide it anymore. Gulag, or G-O-O-G-L-E. Another way to put it, according to Branko, how do you spell collusion? Well, says Ethan Huff for Natural News, after creating the world's most dangerous and evil tech company, Gulag founders have left, turning it over to the fascists who hate humanity in their stead. And he begins in what may come as a shock to many. Google co-founder Larry Page, longtime CEO of Alphabet Inc., Google's parent company, along with fellow Gulag co-founder Sergey Brin, have announced their resignation from the world's most dangerous and evil tech company amid ongoing probes into Google's censorship agenda. CEO Sundar Pichai, who infamously lied to Congress about Google's manual interventions via user search results, will reportedly take on Page's former role, making him the CEO of both Gulag and parent Alphabet at the same time. And while Page and Brin may stay on as shareholders and members of Alphabet's board of directors, Pichai will be the new head of, well, everything related to the Gulag. But this doesn't necessarily, says the piece, clear Page and Brin of running what critics claim is a top-down control over Google search results, and that would mean specifically anything political. More recently, Gulag announced they'd be banning upwards of 300 different advertisements put out by the Donald Trump campaign for re-election in 2020, claiming that those ads, unlike ads they like, violate their internal policies. The Trump campaign has publicly responded by claiming that Gulag is muzzling political speech to thwart the upcoming election. And of course, that's just the least of what they're up to on that front. In their departure letter, Page and Brin admitted that Gulag is not what they call a conventional company, to put it mildly. They're more like an international terrorist organization, folks, masquerading as a private corporation. That would be your host's opinion, obviously. Adding that Gulag's evolution as a privately held company means that they need to be managed differently. But still, all of them agree, Gulag provides unbiased, accurate, and free access to information for those who rely on us all around the world. And for those who would rather not, or know what they're being fed, it's anything but. The real trouble is, as they increasingly get their way, they're also increasingly the only game in town. Whether you'd like to try to communicate by phone, or email, or text, or even just access the internet. You knew they were bugging you, tracking you, recording you, and of course profiting from all the databases they were building on you. And now you know they're using all that data as well to manipulate you in more ways than they'll probably ever even let you know. Which takes us to the break. We'll be right back.
There's no place I can be since I found serenity.
You can't take the sky from me.
Mark Hoff, and welcome back to the second segment for this evening, and let's kick it off with what I call a bit of infringement boogie, or a few more reminders of what it's like to watch a formerly free republic descend into absolute tyranny. And ironically, we'll start first with the example south of the border, gun-free but not really Mexico, where only the peons are truly disarmed, and they've got a lot of bullet holes to show for it. And to compound the irony, let's get the story here. From the Daily Mail, out of gun-free and increasingly knife-free, but not really Great Britain, here's a headline. Drug cartels and police battle it out and leave 21 dead, including four cops and a Mexican town literally riddled with bullet holes less than 50 miles from the U.S. border. The warlike gun battle, they say, erupted in Villa Union, a town of 3,000, on Saturday, as cartel vehicles rolled into the Mexican community and shot up that gun-free Mexican town. And the pictures, folks, look like something out of a Hollywood B-movie. The shootout erupted midday Saturday in Villa Union near the U.S. border, a bit southwest of San Antonio, Texas, and left 21 people dead, including four officers and a number of other officers wounded. Here's the funny but not really ha-ha part. No explanation, say officials, has been offered for the violence, although some of them do admit that something called the Cartel of the Northeast, sounds almost like D.C. Swamp Critters, doesn't it, might be implicated in the violence. From America with a K, and I guess you could call this good news in the sometimes backwards and upside down way we're getting used to, and via the Daily Sheeple, the FBI says that Black Friday gun purchases, based on their utterly unconstitutional background check numbers, are the second largest single day in the history of that infringement program. So I guess you'd have to call it good news and bad news, because if we really had a constitution anymore, there wouldn't be any of these background checks. But the FBI claims to have fielded more than 200,000 background checks for Black Friday gun purchases, continuing a steady surge this year, no doubt fueled by the obvious intent of gun banners to make sure that whatever guns you get now are soon to be your last. The numbers were up 11% year over year and fall just short of the single day record of just over 203,000 back in 2017. And of course, as you probably know, while the unconstitutional background checks required if peons seek to get permission to have one from a federally licensed firearms dealer are not a measure of actual gun sales, the so-called National Instant Criminal Background Check System is, claims the story, a way to gauge market demand. And here I have to pause and say, well, folks, market demand is certainly a lot greater than what the NICS checks shows, because there are no doubt a whole lot of people who would really like to purchase a firearm but aren't willing to beg Big Brother for permission or end up on a list. And while most of the propaganda press won't point that fact out, because it shows just how infringed that God-given, once constitutionally protected right now is, and even the feds admit that the number of actual firearms sold on Friday is probably higher, because, at least for now, peons can still buy more than one firearm at the same time in a single transaction. So to summarize, the bad news here is really obvious, and the good news is that at least more people, a whole lot more of them, seem to be waking up to it. Two very much related stories next from the People's Republic of Virginia, which has now fallen under communist rule and seems really anxious to complete their program of civilian disarmament. Says Mike Adams at Natural News, tyranny alert. Virginia now intends to outlaw, at least if SB 64 is ever passed, and no doubt if it is, it'll get signed anyway, to outlaw all kinds of things, from Krav Maga and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu to kickboxing, Tai Chi, firearms instruction, and any self-defense training, under this bit of idiocy called Senate Bill 64. Now, this one, folks, actually plumbs the depths of stupidity, even for so-called lawmakers in a wannabe communist regime. Says Adams, and he's understating the case here, and we'll talk about that in a second, the new law would instantly transform all martial arts instructors into criminal felons, including those who teach kickboxing, BJJ, Krav Maga, boxing, you name it. It would also criminalize all firearms training classes, including for concealed carry, and criminalize even a father trying to teach his own son how to safely use a hunting rifle. And you have to listen carefully to see just how insane this one is. Okay, well, perhaps the better term would be insidious if you understand the concept of selective enforcement. SB 64 would declare that it becomes a felony to assemble with, quote, one or more persons for the purpose of training with or practicing with or being instructed in the use of any firearm, explosive, or incendiary device or technique capable of causing injury or death to persons, unquote, full stop, and say what? Now think about what you just heard, folks. What they're doing is criminalizing the assembly with others, and here you thought you had a First Amendment right to assemble too, to study anything that might ultimately be capable of causing injury or death to persons. Now let me ask it this way. Can you think of anything that you could study that ultimately, arguably, couldn't be? From driver's ed to pottery making? You heard that right. Virginia now proposes to criminalize getting together, assembling with any persons for the purpose of training about, well, basically anything that might ever be used to cause injury or death to anyone. Goodbye truck driving schools. Oh, for crying out loud, for that matter, goodbye Little League baseball, because, you know, you could certainly kill somebody with a baseball bat if you know how to swing it properly. Now, I can already hear it. Those who haven't been paying the least bit of attention to how we got to the insane place we now are will say, oh, it could never go that far. No, no, fill in the blank. From background checks to TSA to teaching little kids about fisting in grade school, nothing like that could possibly ever happen now, could it? Would they really take a perfectly reasonable law and go that far over the top? Well, once they've already decided that shall not be infringed and Congress shall make no law, don't have any meaning anymore anyway? And come to think of it, obviously, neither do elections. And besides, Mark, you didn't read the entire thing, the rest of that law, about how teaching or demonstrating a technique that might cause injury or death is verboten with this qualifier. If you knew or had reason to know that such training might be employed in or in the furtherance of civil disorder. So yeah, see, there's a safeguard that's not even worth as much as the parchment the Second Amendment was once printed on. Just listen to that weaselly language. New or having reason to know. And after all, who wouldn't suspect that teaching someone jujitsu or karate or how to use a gun wouldn't be used in the commission of civil disorder? Or that the mere act of having a gun, or training, or preparing in any way for the Second Civil War they're so hot to trot and get started, probably qualifies as planning for exactly that kind of thing. Especially, of course, if you understood that the original purpose of the Second Amendment was for exactly that purpose. Suffice it to say that I doubt many Virginians in the current legislature have paid much attention to some of the most famous Virginians of all time. From Washington and Madison to Patrick Henry and Thomas Jefferson, who would no doubt be a multiple felon under this new bit of tyranny, because as you may recall, and I'm sure they don't, he once said the strongest reason for the people to retain the right to keep and bear arms is, as a last resort, to protect themselves against tyranny in government. Unquote. Now, in fairness, Zero Hedge, under the headline, Virginia gun owners could face felony charges under the new Paramilitary Activities Amendment, claims that at least a variant of the proposed law has been on the books for quite a while now. It's just that the latest insanity, folks, has moved to the place where existing language is certainly open to the kind of interpretation your host is suggesting is, well, as we've seen elsewhere, downright inevitable. No, they claim, it doesn't declare tactical training to be outright illegal. Just only if they should have suspected that it might end up being in furtherance of whatever they call civil disorder nowadays. And yeah, here comes the rub. That might include things like the so-called ill-fated Unite the Right rally. Because evidently, if someone brings a firearm to a place where they think they might be at risk of some, you know, Antifa guy hitting them over the head with a bike lock and a sock, and some prosecutor tries to charge them, saying that the goal of bringing that firearm out in public wasn't for self-defense, which will be made illegal pretty soon anyway, but maybe to intimidate the poor Antifa guy. Well, you see, at the very least, then they can make a Roger Stone kind of example out of people like that. And even if they beat the felony rap, they may still end up being bankrupted by the legal costs. And if nothing else, then Virginia can come and take their guns away under the red flag theft provisions. So I'll say it again. No wonder people are looking to get what guns they can while they still can. And don't forget you need ammunition for them, too, because that's not only next, but already in progress. We'll follow that up with still a bit more from the new Civil War 2.0 battleground of Virginia, courtesy of sites like Ammoland, DC Dirty Laundry, and GunsAmerica.com, or that traitorous enemy of the Constitution, Michael Bloomberg, in case you wonder which one we're talking about, as Ammoland put it, bought and paid for a whole bunch of Virginia legislators, sick, that are newly in office, and have wasted no time introducing all kinds of legislation to make the Old Dominion's gun laws even worse than the billionaire's home state of the People's Republic of New York. A whole lot of Virginians, however, still seem to remember their heritage and don't want to put up with it. And as some of the headlines proclaim, they've awoken a giant. Okay, sick. Because 20-plus Virginia counties have now become Second Amendment sanctuaries overnight. Some stories say, latest count, 23 and rising. Virginia gun owners, they all say, have gathered by the hundreds at Board of Supervisors meetings in counties across the state to send a message to the newly elected far-left legislature in Richmond.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Among other recent abominations, SB 16, introduced by the treasonous state senator Richard L. Sands Law, I think is the correct pronunciation, although they left out the N in the copy I'm looking at, which would create a total ban on any and all commonly owned semi-auto firearms like the AR-15. Even worse, the ban would extend to common firearm parts. And the restrictions in the proposed anti-constitutional legislation, and its theft too, folks, don't even grandfather current so-called owners. It's clearly all about firearms confiscation, and current owners would be forced to dispossess themselves of their property or become Class 6 felons overnight. Well, so say the felons and the state legislature, anyway. Declares this bit of theft, it is unlawful for any person to import, sell, transfer, manufacture, purchase, possess, or transport an assault firearm, Achtung, and if you do, you're a Class 6 felon, subject to up to 5 years imprisonment. You formerly free citizen, you. So here's the good news. While there have been sanctuary cities for the Second Amendment elsewhere across the country, no other state has ever seen so many formed in such a short span of time. Philip Van Cleve, president of the citizen gun rights group Virginia Citizens Defense League, which has been fighting for rights there since 1994, and takes credit for helping turn that state from a may issue to a shall issue state, said, quote, "It's sending a message to Richmond saying we don't want any more gun control out here." And he added he's been active in the gun rights movement in that state for 20 years, but he's never seen anything quite like this. Quote, "Nothing even touches the activity in Virginia right now. A lot of gun owners were sleeping, but now they've awakened the sleeping giant. All these gun owners that have been sound asleep have suddenly woken up." Unquote. And as Guns America puts it, the numbers don't lie. Out of Virginia's 133 counties and independent towns, 23 have already declared themselves to be Second Amendment sanctuaries, and another 53 are considering the measure. Meetings hoping to send that message across the state are literally overflowing with angry people. Over 1,000, for example, showed up at the Board of Supervisors meeting in Shenandoah County, and another 700 in Washington County. While in a number of other counties, the standing room only crowd simply overflowed into hallways and front lawns. And even the sanctuary numbers don't necessarily reflect the complete trend, because there are a number of sheriffs who have independently vowed not to enforce any new gun control or confiscation. All of which have tyranny's cheerleaders at the WAPO really worried, causing them to openly whine in a bit of op-ed tripe over the weekend that, quote, "Mischief makers with an agenda, as if they don't have one, promote gun sanctuaries," they put it in quotes, "in Virginia." How dare they? And it kind of makes you wonder, folks, if the people at the WAPO have ever, ever opened a book on actual United States history. And it doesn't get too much yellower or anti-constitutional than this, folks. Listen to their opening paragraph. "Vigilantism with its alluring tingle of defiance and frontier justice, conjures a cinematic idea of American individualism. A similar impulse is at work among advocates of the so-called Second Amendment sanctuary movement. Wait a minute. How dare they have sanctuary cities? We are the ones who invite lawless criminals in mass, and encourage them to say to hell with your culture, your republic, and your rule of law. Back to the tripe. Yes, a similar impulse is at work among advocates of the so-called Second Amendment sanctuary movement, a trend in mainly rural counties. In other words, folks, places where they haven't been dumbed down, and even children still get taught basic gun safety, as opposed to, well, you don't even have to imagine anymore. They'll teach grade school kids the three basic rules of homosexual etiquette and fisting, and don't have a problem with drag queen story hour, but shriek at the very concept of kids being introduced to the three basic rules of gun safety. Back then to the WAPOpocracy. Basically, they're saying, you have these hicks declaring they will refuse to enforce restrictive, and they don't put the word in here, but I will, anti-constitutional state gun laws. Both are examples of individuals who, get this, lacking legal authority, put themselves above the law, whatever the hell that means nowadays, thereby promoting chaos. Unquote, and what? You mean the kind of chaos they have down in gun-free Mexico, or gun-free Chicago, or gun-free New York, or gun-free L.A.? Oh, yeah. This is about as bad as it gets. In Virginia, they say, the movement has lately become a fad, spurred by legislative election results that will, starting in January, you know, hand the anti-Second Amendment fascists complete control of the state. Well, except for the inconvenient fact that some of those peons still consider themselves to be a free people, and that they've maintained the ownership of their firearms, as Jefferson reminded us, to protect themselves against tyranny in government, the kind of thing they're seeing right there in Virginia. And this would be funny if it wasn't so incredibly hypocritical. The idea, they admit, a few paragraphs down, and the term itself, has gained traction in Western states and elsewhere, inspired by sanctuary cities that have adopted policies barring cooperation with federal immigration officials to deport unauthorized migrants. Well, they say the distinction between the two sanctuaries is basic, and I will note, downright imbecilic. Localities of past resolutions declaring themselves Second Amendment sanctuary jurisdictions are threatening to ignore laws, you know, the real kind as opposed to the kind that simply protect us from invasion, enacted by duly elected state legislatures and then signed by governors, even if they're obviously criminal oath breakers. Immigration-focused sanctuary localities, they claim, are breaking no law. Good grief. Rather, they're simply refusing purely voluntary cooperation in service to federal law enforcement. And on that note, folks, let's take a second to ponder the irony of the WAPO ignorance. The shot heard round the world was fired at Lexington and Concord Greens when the founders decided they'd had enough of King George and his redcoat gun banners and confiscators, who were coming to do precisely what these leftist gun banners have said would never happen up until now, when they're saying, oh yeah, we are going to take your guns, you can count on it. We've been lying about it for years. Yeah, we lied when we put our hands on that Bible, and we're still lying about it when we tell you that you shouldn't believe what we're actually saying, just believe what we say we're saying. The WAPO defends sanctuary cities, who in turn defend invaders, under the idiotic claim that they're refusing purely voluntary cooperation with those actually trying to enforce Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And they, of course, ignore the fact that the founders rejected a lawless government of King George III, who pushed on the then colonies all kinds of abominations, which they said all had in, quote, direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states, unquote. So what did they do? To paraphrase the idiots at the WAPO, they refused purely voluntary cooperation, basically because governments are supposed to be based on the consent of the governed. And they realized, unlike the state worshippers there on the banks of the Potomac, that that refusal of purely voluntary cooperation might sometimes have to be backed up with force, which is why they wrote down those real laws in the first place. At least, folks, the WAPO is no longer hiding what they're really about, either. Which means this fits here next, especially because the waste stream would just as soon ignore anything like this. There's a fascinating article, says RedState.com, written by Judicial Watch's Chris Farrell, former counterintelligence case officer, that recently appeared on the Gatestone Institute's website. And just when we thought we could recite every text message ever exchanged, well, and that's not very likely, is it, between Lisa Page and the infamous scumbag Peter Strzok, here comes a new one. In December 2015, we now see Page wrote to Strzok, quote, "You get all our Oconus lures approved?" with a little smiley face. Because believe it or not, says the author, the FBI is actually prohibited, or supposed to be, but hey, that's what that Constitution thing buys you nowadays, from such activities as investigating a major political party's candidate for the presidency. So they needed to find an alternative. Farrell explains that their alternative was to manufacture a foreign counterintelligence, or FCI, threat that they could then re-import back into the United States. And he put it this way, citing plausible deniability, which, of course, as we recall, is the holy grail of covert activities. It was in reach for the plotters that they could develop an FCI operation outside the continental United States. Now, here comes the acronym OCONUS, outside the continental United States, involving FBI confidential human sources, think Halper, Mifsud, and who knows how many others, that would act as lures, that's intelligence jargon associated with double agent operations, to ensnare the people that were never supposed to win the election anyway, but remember, they needed an insurance policy. We have evidence of these machinations, says Farrell, from December 2015, when FBI lawyer, sick, liar is the better way to pronounce it, Lisa Page texted her paramour, the infamous Peter Strzok special agent, and asked, "You get all our Oconus lures approved?" Well, he notes, the coup plot failed, but the chief coup conspirators are still free, crisscrossing the country on their bogus bribe book tours and appearing as paid contributors to fake news ministries of truth like MSNBC and other criminally negligent networks. And for bitter examples of where gun confiscation and all kinds of ism-like tyrannies from socialism to communism to fascism invariably end, we don't simply have to turn south of the border. There's Europe, for example, and particularly Germany, where you'd think they might have learned the lesson. Here's a piece from Paul Joseph Watson via Summit News about German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Achtung, who said that, no kidding, folks, freedom of expression must be curtailed in order to keep society free, whatever the blankety-blank that means over there. During a speech to the German parliament late last week, the wannabe Führer said, quote, "For all those who claim that they can no longer express their opinion, I say this to them. If you express a pronounced opinion, you must live with the fact that you will be contradicted." She said, "Expressing an opinion does not come at zero cost, but freedom of expression has limits." She added, as some in the Bundestag could be heard voicing their opinions, while they still can. And get this, folks, she followed that up by saying, "Those limits begin where hatred is spread." Well, unless, of course, the right kind of people are spreading it, it would seem. They begin where hatred is spread. They begin where the dignity of other people is violated.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
This House will and must oppose extreme speech. Otherwise, our society will no longer be the free society that it was. Unquote. And you could be forgiven for thinking that somebody should have pointed out to her that whatever violates the dignity of other people just might be subjective, and that those who get to define the speech probably make the rules. But I think she already knew that. Watson goes on to note that there have been a whole lot of Germans who've already found themselves hit with charges of hate speech for merely pointing out hate facts, like migrants being responsible for a huge increase in crimes and sexual assaults. And at no small risk, Watson's a Brit, remember, where they don't have a First or a Second Amendment. He notes that this happened despite the German government's own numbers showing that violent crime in Germany rose by 10% between the years 2015 and 16. But that more than 90% of that rise was attributable to young male refugees. Uh-oh. And just to bring that home, we'll go quickly with this story from Robert Spencer at Jihad Watch, who asks, why does this keep happening? Yes, in Germany, A Muslim migrant and suspected Syrian refugee raped a woman, even though police were close by. And he notes that the survivor of a Muslim rape gang in the UK pointed out those rapists would quote the Quran to her, claiming their actions were justified by Islam. And they even list the various portions out of the surah that they claim suggest if women do not cover themselves adequately, then they may be abused, and that abuse is obviously justified. In this case, anyway, as a patrol car was driving by, the victim managed to jump out, stop the car, and beg them for help, telling them she'd been raped by the Syrian, who was, it turns out, a migrant known to police. So an exercise for the listener. How many morals can we count up in stories like these?